the UCR Podcast.
Happy holiday weekend to everybody out there hearing this right now. Maybe you're going to make good use of the long holiday weekend by going to see Triumph and April Wine here in the coming days. And we've got a conversation today with April Wine guitarist Brian Greenway, who's about to mark 50 years with the band next year, and he is already celebrating in fine fashion as the two Canadian groups perform across the United States and Canada in amphitheaters and arenas, and they're a little more than halfway through the tour, which will wrap June 10th. You can see all of the concerts that are still ahead on the Rock and Roll Machine Reloaded Trek by visiting UCR's website at ultimateclassicrock.com. Brian and I get into a lot of different subjects today, including his long history with April Wine, the stories behind many of the band's big 80s hits, what this current resurgence of the group has been like, and he shares the story behind why one of their tours back in the day didn't go so well. It's Matt Wardlaw. If this is your first time listening to the UCR podcast, follow us so you will get new episodes as we put them out. And if you could take 5 seconds, leave us a review wherever you're listening. If you dig the podcast, it helps us all out a lot. AprilWine.ca and TriumphMusic.com, those are the places to be to stay up to date with all of the latest information on both groups. And do not miss your chance to see these shows. I'm going to get to see this tour in about a week, and I can't wait. Okay, let's get to it. Here's our conversation with Brian Greenway of April Wine. Enjoy. I guess, tell me about this current tour with Triumph. Like, it seems like it's probably been a pretty amazing experience all around, both playing these shows and seeing Triumph do their thing.
Well, I knew Gil and Rick from years ago, but I never thought we'd be doing this in 2026. I'm really happy they got back together. Good for them for doing it. They're drawing the crowds. I never knew that they had such a big following in the U.S., kind of like Rush, you know, the same way we were playing with back then in the early. So I'm really happy to see that for them. It's a respect for sure. People are in their seats from the beginning of the show to see us, as well as Triumph. So I'm really happy about that. There's a lot of goodwill towards the tour. It's nice to see a tour that's been successful.
Yeah, I know you guys were here in the Cleveland area within the past year playing at the Goodyear Theater, but it's like, I think that there's this whole, you know, audience of folks that maybe are not as hardcore music fans as some of us. And so for those people, when they see a show go on sale, that it's like, oh man, I can go and see April Wine and Triumph all in the same night. That's kind of like for people that like just like AOR rock from like the 70s and 80s or love Canadian bands or whatever the case is, it's kind of a dream double bill. So I'm really happy it came together in this way.
It's a real guitar show between Rick and Phil X and myself and Mark. There's a lot of guitar slinging going on.
You mentioned that you knew Rick and Gil back in the day. Like, how did you guys first cross paths?
Well, actually, we were touring together back in Texas back in the mid to late 70s. And we're going back on this route to San Antonio in a few days.
Which was a hotbed.
Yeah, it'll be, 43 years or more since we were together down there.
What are kind of the memories that you remember about, because that is something I hear about all the time. It's just like how popular Triumph and a lot of bands, Judas Priest is another one, but just like there's all these kind of like hard rock / heavy metal / just rock bands that had a lot of popularity in Texas and particularly San Antonio. So that must be, I'm sure that some of those shows were pretty unique, you know, compared to just being in this one other city on a particular night. Like the Texas shows seemed like they made an impression with a lot of the bands.
They did. And I got a theory about that. I think it goes back to live radio stations, terrestrial radio, when disc jockeys could play what they wanted to. I'll back that up. I said in Montreal, my hometown, Supertramp and Supertramp, Styx, they became really big in that area before they were getting big in other areas. And that's due to radio play, people calling in. Can you play that? And then the jocks playing it. And probably the same thing in Texas, playing this stuff. You don't get that anymore.
It's pretty incredible.
Another example. Yeah. Another example is St. Louis from Casey. In St. Louis, they were playing a song from an album of ours called "Shot Down," and it was a huge song there, but nowhere else.
Yeah, Casey is kind of its own thing. They have a whole thing they call Casey Classics, and it's like there's all these bands that many music fans probably haven't thought about in a bunch of years. That if they still play shows, they will go to St. Louis and play shows. And so it's kind of cool. Like, you know, they're still big, like, supporters of Head East and any other band you want to name. But it's like, I think one of the interesting things that I first learned about St. Louis, just on the larger scale, was that no city loves Sammy Hagar more than that city. So it's like, they've always been a rock and roll town, but there are, we're not going to take the time, but it's like we can make a list of like the 5 or 10 bands that St. Louis absolutely loves. And it's like they are serious about their rock and roll. Very similar to what we were just talking about with San Antonio, but it goes to a whole new level when you're talking about St. Louis. So, yeah, yep. It's interesting. Yeah.
The quality of the radio stations, I think, made those cities what they are as far as musical tastes go.
So for you, basically next year will mark 50 years of you doing the April Wine thing, which is pretty incredible. I wondered, what that made me think of was, for you, like we've been talking about touring America, for you, what was it like touring America for the first time? What are kind of the memories of that, which kind of stick with you, of those early days coming to America?
Oh, I think I had a party in every state in the lower 48. Oh, it was a good time. And those were the days, right? And it was the party. Late 70s. It was so much fun because we were out there with Rush, with Styx, with Foreigner, with Nazareth, big audiences, seeing all these different places, sometimes having time off to explore the different cities around us, and especially for Canadians going down there in the wintertime in Canada and it being nicer weather. It was a real dream going, playing in LA and playing in Florida, playing in the Midwest. You got to see it all. It was really nice education, you know, where people are all the same everywhere. It's just the license plates make you look different.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that I was thinking about was, I know that I've heard, I don't know, I think it's been like even like somebody like Jim Cuddy from Blue Rodeo, like there's a lot of folks that I have heard talk about in Canada, look, you know, there were times coming up playing in bars or wherever you were playing where it's just like, you guys played in front of tough crowds that, you know, really gave you the business no matter what town you were in. So it seems like that was one thing that was common between Canada and the United States. But you talked about the educational part of things. Like, did touring America kind of, I guess, toughen up your skin in other ways that were interesting?
Well, you got out there and did what you're supposed to do every night, and your rehearsal, your training took over and it became muscle memory. You did your show. If you're a performer, you did it. That's what separates a lot of musicians that are really are great players, but they're not performers. You got to interact with the audience because that's the show. They interact back with you and they want it that way. If you're just going to stand there, it's a boring show. But if you're having fun and smiling, I remember seeing Rod Stewart for the first time with his small faces, and he's running all over the stage and laughing, and people are going, I want to have him as my new best friend, you know?
How did you end up seeing the small faces?
I don't know. They came to They came to Montreal, and they came to Quebec City, and my friends and I were big fans of them, so we would go to all the shows. And I just, they were just so perfect. They were like another version of the Stones having a lot of fun up there in the typical British way.
Was that one of your first concerts? Like, what's the first show that you remember that really had like an impact on you?
Wow. Well, I remember when the Beatles came to Montreal, my mom said, well, I'll buy you a ticket or I'll buy you an album. I said, I want the album. I have a feeling that I'm not going to be able to hear anything at the shows. And I was right.
That's fantastic.
After that, I don't know what my first show was. I can't remember. I remember going to see Jimi Hendrix in 68 in Montreal, Cream in Montreal. We'd go down to some of the other clubs and see Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee and the Fugs and Frank Zappa in the late 60s. There was a lot of eclectic bands around.
That's a great spread of things.
I was really into blues. I was into rock and... and top, you know, pop stuff, cover band stuff. But then I got really into blues when after in the summer of, I think it was 67, when my neighbor had the John Mayall album with Eric Clapton on it, the Beano album, as it's come to be. And I just got taken with that kind of guitar playing. And there was local dances around with the local bands in the arenas, small arenas. And there was one band called the Staccatos, which was a pop band, but there was another band, and they had a guitar player, Louis McKelvey, and he just got back from England, and he was playing all the Clapton-style stuff. And I was, whoa, listen to this guy. It just everything stopped, and I started going that direction. So that's the blues rock and the education of music. You know, that was the way you learn how to play music back then. There was none of this YouTube stuff. You know, you lifted the needle on the album back and forth on the vinyl, or you went and saw somebody play. Well, I did go see John Mayall when Mick Taylor was playing guitar for him before he joined the Stones. And it was the McGill Student Union Ballroom. We all sat on the floor cross-legged. There was really not much of a stage. Randy opened for as a piano player. Darn it.
Oh, Randy Newman.
Randy Newman opened for them. Yeah, it was really a good
show.
What
a bill. Wow, that's a bill.
And I'm sitting about 10 feet away from Mick Taylor playing his Les Paul through a borrowed 59 Dual Showman, Fender Dual Showman guitar amplifier. And he was getting applauded for every song, every solo he did. And I was just, and I went home that night and I learned how to get the quaver, the vibrato on the strings by watching him that night. So that's how you learn. Although later in life, we were relearning Say Hello to Put It in the Show from the Harder Faster album. And I couldn't remember the solo. So I went on YouTube and said, someone teach me how to play this solo Brian Greenway solo from Say Hello. And there was a guy that had done that. So I said, oh, that's what I did. Okay. So I learned it off of YouTube. And I should have thanked him, but I just quickly got off and then went to rehearsal.
That's got to be so interesting for you, though, seeing other people play your stuff in that way. And you named an instance where it was helpful to you, but it's just like, you can, like you say, you can find that for pretty much, in this case, any April Wine song. That's got to be crazy for you to see people kind of, like we would say about, you know, British versus America, like in this case, kind of selling your solos back to you, you know?
Yeah. And a lot of the time in the studio, we do comps of the solo. So that you do the solo for an hour and then you get bits and pieces you take that were the best parts rather than sit and learn the whole thing again. Just go track to track and put a comp together, compilation of the solo. So you learn your compilation. And sometimes it wasn't a natural way of playing. So you learn a new way of playing by doing that. And what this fellow would sit down and then learn the solo, go, oh, cool. And learn where it was played on the neck. So these were good players that did that, I'm pretty sure. I just, before I was talking to you, Matt, I was, I've got a ringtone that for an alarm, Follow You, Follow Me, Genesis.
Oh, great. Yeah.
And I said, I've always been curious how that started. And I was trying to mess around with it. And I just got on YouTube before I talked to you. And they go, oh, yeah, it's in D. And there's only the D and E, G and the G string going in. And it's muted. I went, that's why. And there's no delay. That's why that extra D comes in there with the G. So it's just the flanger that's giving you that tone.
You can really lose yourself with some of those Genesis records, right?
Yeah. And you know what? I wasn't a big fan of them when they first came out. But just in the past few years, I've gone back to listening to them. And they remind me of that time period when Shroom FM in Montreal was playing those songs and just how I felt and how the world felt and just hearing them, the sounds come out. Because it was early computer-generated digital stuff on keyboards. And I was like, oh, yeah, this is such a nice feeling, a memory, a nostalgia, you know? And that's where music can take you. When people come into these shows, they love the songs. The songs aren't dating themselves. They've created good memories.
Yeah, I mean, you were around for pretty much all, you know, if we take out like some of the earlier songs from the 70s, you were around for pretty much all the quote unquote big April Wine hits. Are there some of these songs? I mean, we think about all these songs like Sign of the Gypsy Queen, Just Between You and Me, and so on. Like these are songs that have become radio staples. Are there songs in that vein, in that realm that you're surprised at the staying power that they ultimately had? Because there's a lot of folks that I talk to like yourself that, of course, like they don't know sometimes, you know, when you record something, you're like, oh, something's going to happen with this one. But there's a lot of folks, it seems like more often are like, we had no idea. So I'm just wondering, like staying power wise, are there any of these that went the distance that were perhaps a little bit surprising to you?
Yeah, Roller was one of those from the First Glance album. That was the third single off that album. The first two didn't attract any radio play. The band at that time was frustrated with that because we put a lot into that and we're planning to move to LA to see if we could get some traction down there. And I was dreading the thought of moving to LA. You know, I was not making a lot of money back then. And these guys were, I wasn't part of the company, so I was on a salary. They're paying the taxes and they all had houses and they're going to move down there. Me with my 73 Cutlass, I'm in and rented apartments. Where am I going to live in LA? You know? And then all of a sudden, in late 1978, I guess it was, Roller started getting a lot of airplay out of Saginaw, Michigan. And our good capital team with Mike Diamond out of Detroit and Jeff up in Saginaw was a program director. That song became, I think, almost number one in their station. And they're what they have reporting stations, right? So every week they report who's getting the most airplay. And that would attract the national attention. And that was one of the songs. And it started getting national attention. It was the right song at the right time. We put a shuffle in the mix where nobody else had them, I guess. And so we got lucky.
That's pretty
Everybody
fantastic.
Everybody gets lucky. Trying to get hit in the radio, there's various ways to do it. I've heard over the years of a gifting presents to disc jockeys or whatever.
Yeah.
But this was just, I don't know what happened. It just got there and we never moved to LA. And
wow.
I was happy about that.
It worked out. Oh, that's cool.
I don't know what type of person would have been in LA. Probably knowing me at the time, at that time of my life in the late 70s, I would have probably just been a just one of those casualties in the canyons.
to kind of continue hitting on some of the songs, what kind of sticks with you about the experience of recording Sign of the Gypsy Queen?
April Wine had, over the years, done quite well with cover tunes from Bad Side of the Moon from Elton John to Could Have Been a Lady by Hot Chocolate. And Tony Wilson, who wrote that, just passed away with Hot Chocolate. To Lawrence Hutt's Sign of the Gypsy Queen had been a hit in Canada and Canada only in 1970. And we took that song. It was pretty much the arrangement, but we added the halftime section for the solo. And then Miles wrote a third verse coming out of the solo, go to the outro with the chorus. And just with the three guitar harmonies on it and the weight of recording technology at that time, it made it into a great song. Versus the earlier technology. Text got a lot to do with how records sound, you know?
It's just interesting to me because I think of that song and just similarly, although they're different songs, I think of a song like Lunatic Fringe by Red Rider. It's like those were a couple of songs that just had a certain atmosphere to them. And for you guys, Sign of the Gypsy Queen is an example of how you would sometimes create a certain atmosphere with a song. And that's one of them that kind of just drew you in.
Yeah, it's classic chord changes in E minor, you know, E minor to D to A minor to C. And then the climax, da 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 da. We as humans love those minor keys, especially me. So that's why I'm talking about it. And put that with a minor key, a three guitar part harmony over that is and the intro. You've got a nice layering sound that is very attractive, and it's hard to talk about a song to that to the public sometimes or to people because they you're talking about music, it's not a product. Well, yes, it is a product. As my manager once told me, Bud Prager, when I was doing my solo project, once the record was finished, he says, Brian, whatever happens from here on in, it's got nothing to do with music.
How did you connect with Bud Prager? What a character. Another one.
Yeah, I love Bud. I after April Wine was breaking up in 84, we did another album and the drummer for that album session was Marty Simon out of Montreal. And I knew him from years ago. And when Miles wasn't in the studio at night, he said, here, I've got some songs. Let's demo them and see what you sound like. So him and I were annoying. For me, I was working on little demos so he could represent me. So he introduced me to Bud and sold me to Bud. And Bud then got me a deal with Atlantic Records. And we proceeded to do the record. We got Andy Newman on drums. Al LaNova was on the record playing some stuff, some of Corey Hart's band. Man, it was sounding really good. And then when it came for the release date, they said, no, we want to sit on it for 6 months. And by then, Tracy Chapman and Suzanne Vega were the top of the charts, and with very smaller production and folk songs, almost, you know, a whole different venue atmosphere. The Sound Like Us with keyboards and guitars was faded, so it immediately did nothing, and they didn't want to release it in the States, so they took it up to WEA, Warner Electric, Atlantic Records in Toronto, to Bob Roper and Kim Cook, and said, okay, we want you to release it. And they said, well, we don't have a budget for that. So the album did nothing, but they did release it throughout the world. They just didn't promote it. So you know what happens to albums like that. And then Bud was hoping to get working in with Atlantic Records himself to replace Doug Morris, but that didn't happen. So the whole thing toppled.
The music industry, right? Like,
yeah.
Sometimes a story like that, just a couple of sentences, is the music industry in a nutshell. And man, it's like, I don't think you can come across any musician that has spent certainly the amount of time that you have that doesn't have at least one of those stories.
Oh, you got a collection of them, you know. The music is a horrible, shallow place. It also has its bad sides.
Yes, exactly. That was quite a list of names you rolled off, though, like just like, you know, having like Aldo Nova and some of Corey Hart's band on the record. Like, do you know these guys already? Like, did you know Aldo Nova?
Yeah, Aldo and I are pretty good friends. He lives close to me, and we don't see each other a whole lot. Like a lot of musicians I know, I don't hang out with musicians. I don't know why. Usually because they'd always be in clubs drinking, and I don't drink anymore. And I just didn't want to go there. So I tried every now and then to go out to jams and here and that, but I love the jamming, but I didn't like the hanging out. You know, I'd rather be doing something more constructive. Aldo and I wish we could have got together and written more. But I don't write well with other people, I guess, or not that I'm been known to, so I don't have a track record. But he writes a lot. And living in Montreal, I didn't connect with any of the people in Toronto or New York because it was so far away.
Well, I told a journalist friend that I was going to talk to you today, and it's always interesting seeing what comes back. So the text message that came back just said, I like to rock. So what do you kind of recall about that song, you know, coming together? Because I think you guys pulled off something that was a little bit different. On paper, it's kind of hard to maybe have a song called I like to rock and not just have it be ridiculous, but it kind of worked for you guys.
Yeah, Miles had a tendency to have a lot of songs with the word rock in it. And I like to rock tonight. We're going to rock. Hey, can I borrow your rock? You know, hey, nice rock. That's just what he was doing at that time. And we would put it together. Steve Lang, our bass player, was coming from a prog rock band. Jerry Mercer was loving R&B. Gary Moffat, sort of in between prog and R&B and rock, and he's a fabulous, you know, he's like Guitar George. He knew all the chords, you know, but he didn't want to make them shine or sing. Great soloist. If you gave him a solo, Gary would come in and with five different solos, all learned, all done, just boom, play them to you. I would come in with just something. I'll go off the cuff of my heart when I do it. I like to rock. Miles came in with the chords, and we just, I forget how the arrangement went. He had an idea of how it was going to go, but the arrangement came down so long ago, I forget it, except for the end with the Day Tripper and Satisfaction. That was that was something I used to do in a band called All the Young Dudes when I was with Bob Segarini from the Whackers and David and Richie Henman from April Wine up until 73, and then Kooch Strokum and Wayne, I forget Wayne's last name now, I'm bad with names. But we had two drummers, three guitar players, and one bass player. And we were playing bars around Montreal, and it was the summer of 73, 74, 75. we had a good following, and it was a drinking following, and we get bored on stage. Well, sometimes we played this one place for 5 or 6 weeks, and we would try to play two songs at the same time because we had two drummers. We're just being really silly. So we played Day Tripper and Satisfaction at the same time to see if we could get away with it. And that's where that came from. So when we're doing I Like to Rock, I don't know why. Maybe I started playing in the studio and Gary picked it up because he had seen the band and Nick Blagona and engineering us with Miles. Says, yeah, put that in there. It's novel, you know.
That's pretty fantastic. Well, the same buddy that said I Like to Rock, he saw you guys here in the States at the Stanley Theater in Pittsburgh as April Wine tours with Squeeze and the Tubes were headlining. I wondered what's a good story from that tour, because again, that's another interesting bill, you know, to put those three bands together. Like, I would say 2/3 of it makes sense, but yeah, but it's a show I would like to see.
I got to see it only twice because the Tubes fired us after the second show. We were just too rocky for them, I guess.
That's fantastic. So it was short-lived.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I remember it was a fee. It was not happy. You know, I think we were doing too well. And it was a different audience, you know. And I don't know how UK felt because they were just starting out. And boy, there's three different flavors for dinner there.
Wow. You know what? And it seems like otherwise, though, like you guys play with a lot of different folks. The ones that are mentioned a lot are Journey, Styx. Of course, you mentioned, you know, Rush, and we've talked about others. But it seems like generally you guys did not run into a lot of that, did you? It seemed like you guys were generally able to hold your own and fit into bills pretty well, I would guess.
We were the classic opening act, and maybe that's why we're here again, because we would attract people, help sell the Deadwood, as they would say in the industry, and give a good show for 40 yeah. minutes to start off the show. So we could hold our own. You didn't have to worry about us. We had a good crew. We had a good relationship with the managers and then the promoters. So everything went well. There was no Cinderellas and no prima donnas going on. We worked well. We didn't cause any problems. We did exactly what they hoped that an opening act would do. And we did it until we could start doing our own headline. Do it until they don't want you to do it anymore. Because, you
absolutely.
Know, they're taking all the risks. They're paying all the transport trucks. But they're also taking all the money. But in the meantime, you're getting a good following.
Yeah, it's just interesting to hear that story about the Tubes, because Van Halen were pretty notorious. Like, they toured with Journey, they toured with Black Sabbath. Like, anybody that took Van Halen out in 1978 quickly realized they had made a really bad decision because they were getting blown off the stage by these guys. So you guys, like, were able to, I don't know, I think just, like, stylistically, and there's a lot of reasons that it just seems like you guys would have fit in better. So it makes sense. So yeah, that's interesting to hear. Let's talk about one of the big shows. And that is, you come in after the band had already played those shows at the Elmo with the Stones, but you guys do get to do another round with the Stones in Buffalo the next year. What was that experience playing with the Stones band?
We had played in North Bay the night before, and we had driven down in two Cadillac limousines. Not exactly
nice.
A bus, you know, at stretches. It was a stretch. Anyway, a little uncomfortable. And then getting there, I mean, all of a sudden, Peter Rudge, the Stones manager, is in the car with us because we're trying to get through traffic with our management's there. I'm with Miles and Terry and Donald and Peter in the limo. They're talking all these things. I'm just like a fly in the wall listening to all these stories and what's been going on. Wow. Because they know each other from the Elma Combo from 3 or 4 months earlier, the previous year. We get there. The Atlanta Rhythm Section was on the show. Journey was on the show. Ainsley Dunbar was playing drums with Journey at that point. And somehow Ainsley and I hit it off really well and managed to get just plastered on Pina Coladas. And I'm the young kid. Oh, wow, I'm hanging out with Ainsley Dunbar. He wants another pina colada. Far be it for me to refuse. So I was having a good time. And he says, let's go meet. Have you met Keith and Mick before? I said, no, I haven't. He says, let's go meet them. So we walked on to Cater. I remember walking into catering, Matt, and going up to the table. And I don't remember a damn thing after that. It's you know, life went, no, you're not going to remember this.
I could see that. That makes sense. It happened, though. That's great.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. I don't know what they think of me. And Ainsley, I didn't see him after that either. So I don't know if I suddenly became nasty and was taken away by security or just one of those mind melts that you don't remember. Anyway, that 11 years ago, I quit drinking. My wife requested it, so I said yes. The best thing I ever did. I wish I had done it that day because it would have been an interesting meeting. I did meet in Germany at the Sugar Shack, a legendary club in Munich. Sitting down there, we were in town doing some shows, and a lad comes up to me and says, "Mind if I sit down?" He introduces himself, Brian May from Queen.
Wow.
So we sit there and just talked about everything, you know, for about half an hour. And then he said, "Have you met Niki Lauda?" And I said, "No." And he's a great race car driver, though. And says, "Oh, he's in the next room. He's a friend of mine. Come on, I'll introduce you to him." And so we went over, and I remember meeting Niki Lauda.
That's fantastic. Oh, that's cool.
But Brian was such a nice fella. I wish we had to change numbers.
Yeah, great. Well, last couple things here. One, just between you and me, we saw what that song did for you guys. How did it feel, you know, when you record this thing? Because it seems like a pretty special song.
Well, it was a special song to record, all right. You know how the simplest songs can be the hardest to do?
Of course.
Yeah. Getting the drum track just right took about 4 or 5 hours. Jerry just, I don't know if he wasn't in the right frame of mind that day, but he was. He gets something right, then it's okay, remember that, go back and do it, and we get it right and not, or do it, not do it, then screw up something else. And I was playing rhythm guitar, because that's just a guy guitar with bass, and I finally gave up because I wasn't getting the right feel with it either. And so Gary, king of tempo and rhythm playing, came in and they got that track. Then we could proceed to put guitars and more guy vocals and then finish it up. The solos that we did on, that Miles played on them, the intro and in between verses and the guitar solo itself were done last in LA just by Miles plugging his guitar into a rat pedal and into the console to get that unique sound.
It's a great sound, man. Don't you kind of love stuff like that that just kind of happens like that? I'm sure you've had some of those moments yourself as a player.
Yeah. What you go into the studio with is not what comes out of there. A classic case is Say Hello. We went in and started playing it. And Nick says, no, that's not how I hear it. He says, so we took the three guitar players down to just Gary playing the each note separately, then triple tracking each note into the chorus. So there's three notes on one note, three on the other, and just muting it. So it sounded like marimbas or steel drums almost. And then with the bass, once the bass was done, he edited out various random notes here and there to make it feel that way. We just went with it. Nick, you're doing great. And Adam, and see how it would have sounded good any other way, actually, after he went through that.
I'm glad that you've done stuff like that, going back and relearning some of those songs that you haven't played or haven't played in a lot of years. Like, it seems like it's probably been really interesting doing what you guys have done with this, you know, revised lineup of the band. And, you know, so it probably gives you some interesting abilities to do some things that are interesting.
When Mark came in to replace Miles, Miles really liked Mark because he could sound a lot like him. And one of Miles's friends verified that to Miles, because Miles was playing a demo of Mark singing and playing an April Wine song when he called. And he thought that Miles was working on something new. He says, that sounds a lot like you. He says, sold. So when I sat down with Mark to just him and I for the first 3 months to learn the songs together, being the two guitar players, I was teaching him how to play the songs, but also how to play the songs as a member of April Wine, not just to play the song, you know, as a tribute thing, and how to sing the song and the little inflections that were done. And because it was only him and I, now we're doing the parts of three guitar players instead of the two of us. So I said, I play a little bit of Gary and he would play a little bit of Miles. And he had the uncanny ability to sit down and learn these complicated solos that were really fast, like on Crash and Burn and I Like to Rock. That, I don't know how he did it. I couldn't have never done it, but he faithfully copied them and just maybe a little bit. He's, you know, this soul spirit, kindred spirit of Miles in Mark. You know, like you say, you find your soulmate. Well, my wife and I are very much the same. So Mark's a lot like Miles. It's interesting. And so we sat down and we learned. I taught him the songs. And then while we're rehearsing now with the band, we would stop him by saying, no, you're not doing it right. And he says, no, you're not doing it right because I've learned the song. And we realized that over the years, the songs, our arrangements had drifted. So we weren't doing them just like the record anymore. And we were so used to that. So it encouraged us to go back and relearn them as well. So when we came out debuting Mark for the first time, it was a freshly reborn band, learning all the songs and playing them the way people were used to hearing them. So, and everything clicked. Remember the first show, the first three or four songs, people weren't too sure about them. And then all of a sudden they all said yes at the same time. Well, yeah, that works. And they started getting into it. And it's been that way ever since.
This is the final thing. And it just is, what's kind of your plan once you have some breathing room? Would there ever be another April Wine album? Like, what do you guys think about that kind of thing?
I sure love to do it. I don't know. The chemistry in this outfit now, even down to the crew, I haven't felt this way about the band being so positive since the late 70s when we were starting to happen again. I'm getting my hopes up. I hope they're not dashed again, you know, like it can happen in this business. But when Miles was here live, he owned the name, he owned the band, he would negotiate the record companies. Now he's not here anymore, so that's all his estate, and it's still being settled. So we can't go out and get a deal, and I don't know what the plans for the band are to keep going. That's what he wanted. I hope that we can get together, the four of us, and write, because there's a chemistry again. Like I said, Mark and I get along great. He's a lot like me in times. We'd sort of do the same things at the same times. It's kind of scary on stage, but it's neat that that happens. You know, it's just the little fairy dust. If we do, it won't be for a while. And what comes out, I'd love it. You know, it's going to sound like April Wine. But it's going to sound like us.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, Brian, thank you for the time, man. We'll look forward to getting to see the show. And I'm glad you guys are out doing these shows. And have a good one out there, man. Lots of fun. Thank you.
Thanks, Matt. Nice talking with you.
We've reached the end of another episode of the UCR Podcast. It is Matt Wardlaw. We appreciate you listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please rate and review wherever you are listening and hit subscribe so that you'll receive future episodes of the podcast from Ultimate Classic Rock.